Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today, we remember the late John Feinstein, a wonderful sports writer and sports commentator for many years on public radio, who passed away last week at the age of just 69. John Feinstein wrote a total of 44 books, some of them nonfiction books about sports, some of them works of fiction designed primarily with young readers in mind. I had the pleasure of speaking with him on more than a half dozen occasions and always enjoyed the experience. I want to share with you today from the Morning Show archives two of the interviews that I did with John Feinstein, beginning with our most recent. On several different occasions, I've had the great pleasure of speaking with best-selling author John Feinstein, especially well-known for the great books that he has written for a variety of sports. And of course, he is also well known to public radio listeners for the contributions that he made over the years. His most recent book is quite interesting, and it is titled The Ancient Eight: College Football's Ivy League and the Game They Play Today. In the course of this book, John Feinstein examines Ivy League football, and of course, that is an array of well-known, renowned universities, and talks about the particular way in which football is played. I mean, not that the rules of the game are different, but the way in which the Ivy League schools approach football and construct their seasons is quite different. And there is a certain culture about the way in which football is played that is quite interesting. And he happened to follow the Ivy League through what was a especially dramatic period, an especially dramatic season beginning in the fall of 2023. And that made this particular undertaking all the more interesting, and of course then is the source of this very, very interesting book. The book is published by Hachette. Again, it's titled The Ancient Eight: College Football's Ivy League and the Game They Play Today. John Feinstein, we welcome you back to the Morning Show.
Greg, good to be with you again. Thanks.
I'm glad we can have this this conversation. Tell our listeners, first of all, when and where or why or how you got the idea to take a good look at the Ivy League in this particular way.
Well, I'll give you the shortest version I can give, because it dates back to my boyhood in New York City when I used to ride the subway to the tip of Manhattan to see Columbia football games. Columbia was terrible in those days, although they do have one piece of history, and that Marty Domras, who was their quarterback when I first started going to games at Baker Field, was the quarterback who later replaced Johnny Unitas for the Baltimore Colts, which is a little piece of history. But throughout my time at the Washington Post, having grown up around the Ivy League, whenever I had a chance to write about players, coaches in the league, I would, because they were always great interviews, as you might expect. And I guess about a year and a half ago, I had just finished a book on David Faraday, the golf announcer, and was searching around in my mind for my next book, and I thought, why not do the Ivy League? I've wanted to cover the Ivy League for years and years. And I called each coach in the league at the time, all eight coaches, and they said they'd give me total access. They'd love to have me come and write a book about their teams and their players. So I suggested it to my publisher, who loved the idea. I wrote a book 20-plus years ago about Patriot League basketball called The Last Amateurs. And what I found in writing that book was you don't have to be rich and famous to have a good story to tell, or a great story to tell in some cases. And so we decided to go ahead with the book, and I can honestly say, Greg, it was a pleasure. I interviewed 82 players. Not one of them was a bad interview. They were all good interviews. They all had stories to tell and were willing to share those stories. And then, as you mentioned, a very tragic and dramatic piece was added to the story sadly, when Buddy Tevens, the longtime Dartmouth coach, was hit by a truck riding a bicycle in Florida on vacation and never recovered from his injuries. He died 6 months later on the Tuesday before Dartmouth's home opener, and I had the opportunity to be in the locker room with the team when Sammy McCorkle, who was the acting coach then and is now the coach, spoke to the team about their coach's death and how he would want them to handle it. And they went out and won the game and amazingly ended up tying for the Ivy League title last season along with Harvard and Yale. So I got a dramatic, though tragic, element in the story that I never thought would come about, never wanted to come about, obviously.
Right, and that's one of actually several tragedies that also figure into the story of this particular season. One other thing about Buddy Tevens, you tell us in the acknowledgments, in your words, he never got to coach a game during my research, but nevertheless played a critical role in my writing this book. Explain the role that Coach Tevens played in this project, even though by the time you actually undertook it in earnest, he sadly was no longer coaching.
Right. There are several aspects to this question. First of all, Buddy had coached in the played in the Ivy League at Dartmouth, coached in the Ivy League twice at Dartmouth, first in the 80s and then starting in 2005. And as his successor, Sammy McCorkle, said, when he had to inform the team that Buddy had died, it occurred to him that every person in that room, player and coach, had been brought to Dartmouth by Buddy Tevens, that he was the head coach who recruited all the players and the head coach who hired all the coaches. So he had a tremendous influence on the book in that sense. But also, his best friend in life was Tim Murphy, who was Harvard's coach for 30 years. They grew up together. Tim Murphy said to me he ate dinner at Buddy's house as a kid more often than at his own house. And Tim Murphy was at the hospital the day after the accident occurred. He drove 5 hours. He was in Florida, too, to get to the hospital to be with his friend. Was with him a few days before he died. Buddy Tevens was on his mind throughout the season. And I think one of the reasons he retired at the end of last season was that Buddy was no longer around. They had sort of made a pact that they would retire together. They were born 16 days apart. And obviously that couldn't happen. And I think that was literally, well, not literally, that was quite heartbreaking in a metaphorical sense for Tim Murphy and made it difficult for him to go on, even after his team tied for the Ivy League title last season.
We're speaking with John Feinstein, and we're talking about his newest book, which is called The Ancient Eight, College Football's Ivy League and the Game They Play Today. This is a very, very basic question, but I think it's really important that our listeners, especially, you know, this is going to be mostly Midwesterners listening to this interview, and I think a lot of us have a rather sort of fuzzy notion of exactly what the Ivy League is and what
right.
these eight schools share in common, what it is that, in a sense, makes them the Ivy League. And how much variation are there between these eight schools?
It's a very good question. To begin with, the Ivy League schools were national powers in the early 20th century. Princeton played in the first college football game in 1869 against Rutgers. They still have that on their helmets. It says 1869. And most of these rivalries started in the 19th century. They were not yet a league, but they played each other every year. Yale and Harvard have played since 1875. All the schools play each other every year and have played each other just about every year, dating back to the early 20th century. In fact, the first time I walked into Harvard Stadium, I looked up and I saw eight national championship banners. Pretty impressive. The last one was in 1919. I was not around for that, for the record. In 1954, the eight presidents made a decision. They did not want to compete for national championships anymore. They did not want to do the things to sell your soul academically to get players good enough to compete for the national championship. And they formed the Ivy League, and all eight schools had to basically agree to academic standard minimums, and they all have those today. It's hard to get into an Ivy League school, even as an athlete. There are exceptions made. You know, most Ivy League schools, you got to get 1,500 on your boards to have a chance to get in. The football players might have 1,300 or 1,400, but they're all good students, and they graduate. They don't transfer. In today's rules with the transfer portal, you see kids who play for 2, 3, and sometimes even 4 different colleges during their college careers. That does not happen at Ivy League schools. That you come, you stay 4 years, and you're expected to graduate. Most of them do graduate. They play a very high quality level of football. There are somewhere between 12 and 16 Ivy Leaguers in the NFL every season. So it isn't as if they don't have good players. They have good players. They're very competitive. They are at least as competitive as the kids who play at Oregon or Michigan or Ohio State or any power school you want to mention, because most of them understand that when their college career is over, they're going to go to graduate school or they're going to go to a job on Wall Street. They're not going to play in the NFL in 95, 97% of the cases. So the intensity they bring to their 10 games a year, and they only play 10 games. Today, schools play 12, 13, postseason 14, 15 games at the highest level. Ivy League plays 10 games, and the champion is not allowed to participate in postseason, which is a rule I think is silly. Every other sport, Ivy League athletes participate in postseason, but they don't participate in postseason football. It's 10 games, 10 straight weeks, and out. You're done. So it is very different, and the attitude that the players take is, I'm going to give this everything I have, because football is, like with other players, one of their, if not their first love, one of their first loves, and they know it's coming to an end fairly soon.
And you also tell us at some point that because this is a shorter season of just the 10 games, that it is, in some respects, an even more intense experience. And I think I think you quote a player as saying, in the moment, it sort of feels like a marathon. And then when it's all done, you realize it's a sprint. I mean, right. And because it's a lot of football packed into a short amount of time with no bye weeks, with no off weeks, it is a grueling gauntlet in its own way, even if not grueling in terms of sheer length.
Yes. And because there is no bye week, I mean, most FBS teams, the big-time teams, have at least 2 or even sometimes 3 bye weeks to recover from – I'm not going to call them injuries. If you're injured, you don't play. But if you're hurt, you're banged up, you do play. And when you don't have a week off to try to recover, it's that much harder. And sometimes players want to come back a week earlier than they should, because they realize how short the season is. And it's the same for the coaches. They sort of have to resist the urge to put a kid back in who's 80% ready to play, because they know that's not the right thing for the player. And you find with the coaches that there is, I don't want to say more caring, but they're more watchful of making sure that their players who are on the field are healthy.
We're speaking with John Feinstein about his latest book, The Ancient Eight, College Football's Ivy League and the Game They Play Today. One of the adjectives that shows up more than once in your book is stability. And I remember you saying something to the effect that one of the things that was attractive to you about studying Ivy League football and following them closely over the course of a full season was that the Ivy League itself is a very stable entity, unlike other college divisions that are not. I mean, where teams, schools go in and out and in and out and in and out, and it's hard to follow and so on. There's something very tried and true about the Ivy League. But also, beyond that, you talk at one point about how, for whatever reason, a culture has emerged in the Ivy League football programs which involves stability at the coaching position, and that, at least to a large extent, in your words, the Ivy League tends to give coaches a longer leash than their FBS peers. Tell us more about that and the difference that you think this makes.
Well, it makes a big difference, especially for the coaches, because most of the time when you're hired at a school at any level, it's because the team has been struggling, and you're brought in to bring in a new culture, that's the cliche today, and to turn the program around. In the Ivy League, because you can't go out and recruit 30 transfers when you take a job, which most schools do nowadays, the big-time schools do nowadays when a new coach takes over. It takes a while. Buddy Tevens, when he came back to Dartmouth, his fourth season, he was 0-10. And Dartmouth stuck with him, partly because he was an alumnus, partly because he'd had success there before. But they stuck with him, and he turned it around and won 7 Ivy League titles. And you see coaches come in, and their first two seasons almost always are losing seasons. And as you know, in FBS these days, you have 2 losing seasons in a row, and they're looking for a new coach because the boosters are screaming. You know, we can't be losing this way. I mean, there were people talking about Kalen DeBoer getting fired at Alabama, who succeeded Nick Saban this season, because he lost 2 games in his first season. That just doesn't happen in the Ivy League. There is an understanding, A, you need more time, and B, that this is not life and death. This is a sport, and you play it as well as you can. You win as many games as you can, but it's not a life and death thing. And I love that perspective. And the coaches have that perspective. They understand that if they have a bad season, it doesn't mean they're getting fired. Now, if they have 5 bad seasons in a row, they might get fired. I love the description Al Vagnoli, who just retired last year as Columbia's coach, gave me. He had coached at Penn for 17 years and won 9 Ivy League titles. And then he went to Columbia, which was the perennial doormat of the Ivy League, and turned the program around. And I said, what's the difference between coaching at Penn and coaching at Columbia? And he said, at Penn, if I lost 2 in a row, there might be some grumblings that maybe the old coach needs to hang it up. At Columbia, when I won 2 in a row, they wanted to build a statue to me.
That does speak to a very different perspective. I think that's great. That's love that quote. For all of our talk just now about stability, actually, as you began following Ivy League football through this season beginning in the fall of 2023, 2 of the teams were in a bit of turmoil at the head coach position. One of them, we've already talked about, Coach Tevens, very, very seriously hurt in this horrific truck bicycle accident that nearly killed him, and his life was over
he
6 months later.
Sure.
Yes,
right.
But there was another team, involved with this coach you just mentioned, that suddenly found itself in turmoil just as the season was about to begin. Tell us about this.
Well, as I said, Al Vagnoli had turned around the Columbia program. He actually went 8-2 one year, and that's unheard of at Columbia. And they finished in second place in the Ivy League. Columbia's only won the Ivy League once, and that was in 1961. But Coach Vagnoli turned the program around. And then in the spring of 2023, he had a heart procedure. He was turning 70. And after spring practice, he decided that he couldn't do it. He couldn't go through those 10 straight weeks without a break and do the job as well as he felt he needed to do the job. So he waited until August 4th, when preseason camp was getting ready to start, and announced his retirement, because he wanted to be sure that his coaches would still be allowed to coach that year. And that was the good news. They were, but they went 3-7 and all ended up getting fired at the end of last season. And they just couldn't get it together without Coach Vagnoli. Now they have a new coach, John Poppy, who had been an assistant at Columbia in the past, and they're having a very good year. They're 6-2 right now, which at Columbia is nearly miraculous, as history tells us.
So one of the things I think that, especially us in the Midwest, when we think of Ivy League schools, we think at least roughly of students coming from rather privileged backgrounds, that is the likeliest path forward to being able to go to a place like Yale or Harvard or Princeton or Dartmouth and so on.
It ain't cheap.
Right. And so I wonder, though, you really speak so glowingly about the players that you spoke to. And again, you spoke to more than 80 of them. I mean, sat down and had interviews with more than 80 right. of these players. And you seem to have come away from them really quite impressed. And we don't hear from you, at least, of young men who are sort of privileged, feel entitled, and so on. Right. I mean, sometimes that can be the dark side of a privileged background. Tell us more about that, and to what do you attribute kind of the high, let's say, kind of moral stature of a lot of these young men that you interviewed for your book?
Well, to begin with, as you probably know, the Ivy League does not give out athletic scholarships, unlike, for example, my alma mater at Duke, where, you know, the basketball players and football players all have full scholarships, and everybody in the big-time leagues have full scholarships. Ivy League scholarships are based on financial aid, but they are pretty liberal nowadays about giving out that financial aid, especially to athletes. And so a lot of the athletes I met were guys who might have a full ride, might have a partial ride, but many of them, not all of them, but many of them did not come from privileged backgrounds. One great example is a kid, not a kid anymore, named Jalen Ramsey, who went to Princeton and was a good enough player that NFL scouts were coming to games to watch him play last year. He's a left tackle, huge kid, 6'7", 315 pounds, which is atypical for the Ivy League. Usually a kid with that kind of size will end up at an FBS school because they'll recruit him. And he was recruited by FBS schools, but wanted an Ivy League education. He has a brother who went to Harvard. He grew up in Minneapolis, not that far from the murder site of George Floyd. And he was in high school when George Floyd was murdered. And he and a friend of his started a foundation to raise money for inner city kids in Minneapolis to get an education so they could go to college. I mean, imagine two 18-year-olds doing that successfully. Mm. And so he's an exceptional young man. And there were a lot, you know, I could, if you wanted me to, tick off like 82 different stories that might not be as extraordinary as that, but are certainly impressive. And I found most of the young men that I interviewed wanted not just to be football players, but to make a contribution to society when they were out of college. And that's one of the reasons they chose the more difficult route of going to the Ivy League, of having to put together a financial aid package, of having to go to class and having to be expected to graduate, because they don't just want to be football players. And maybe that's why I was so impressed with them.
Right. I want to give you a chance to mention a player by the name of Jake Bingham, who was adjacent to yet another tragedy that is part of the stories right. told in the Ancient Eighth. Someone who should have been a player, but unfortunately perished due to brain cancer, and made that not possible. Tell our listeners just a little bit about this particular story as we finish up.
Well, Jake Bingham was a big-time recruit as an offensive lineman when he went to Penn. But before the start of his freshman year, before he could play a game, he was diagnosed with, as you said, brain cancer. And he continued to go to school, even though he couldn't play football. But the morning that Penn was playing at Columbia, a dreary, dreary day, appropriately so. Ray Priori, the Penn coach, got a phone call early in the morning from Jake Bingham's dad telling him that Jake had passed away. And so on the morning of a game before they went out to play Columbia, a good team, he had to tell his players that their teammate had passed away. And Penn went out, and his roommate, who later took on his number, played brilliantly on the offensive line. And Penn came from behind in the fourth quarter and won a very dramatic and, as you can imagine, emotional game playing for Jake. And they were able to win that game.
Hmm. And I just love that what you tell us, that Bingham's number had been 64, and then a week later he switched to number 62.
62, yeah.
Yeah, which would have been Gabbin's number. And kept right. that number for
Michael
the rest
Gavin.
Of the season.
I had blocked there for a second. You're right, Michael
yeah.
Gavin.
For,
but Jake Bingham played courageously that day. I talked to he and his mom on the field right after the game, and needless to say, they were both in tears thinking about Jake.
Hmm. Well, that's just one of many memorable stories as we follow these eight football teams through the course of this eventful season. And of course, ultimately at the end, it's all about more than football, but football very much at the heart of the story of the Ancient Eight, college football's Ivy League and the game they play today, published by Hachette, the author John Feinstein. John Feinstein, thank you so much for giving us yet another fascinating book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today.
Thank you for having me again. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today we're paying tribute to the late sports writer John Feinstein, who passed away last week. Here is an interview about one of his lovely works of fiction intended for young readers. I always felt that when I spoke with John Feinstein about these kind of books, that his sense of humanity shone forth so clearly. It is always, always a pleasure to be able to reconnect with one of the country's most highly regarded sports writers, John Feinstein. Of course, a very familiar name and voice to NPR listeners and to morning show listeners. I've had the pleasure of speaking with John Feinstein, I think, on five different occasions over the years. And today we're going to be talking about what I believe is his most recent book, and it's one of a number of books he has written so successfully with young readers in mind. This book is called Game Changers, and it is a follow-up on an earlier book called Bench Warmers, and it follows the athletic exploits of two sixth graders, and it is beautifully written. That earlier book, Bench Warmers, was about the sport of soccer. In this particular novel for young readers, we are transported to the basketball court, and these two young people who find their desire to succeed at the game of basketball thwarted by a couple of different complications, and all written so effectively by John Feinstein. And we're going to talk with him for the next few minutes about this new book published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. John Feinstein, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Greg, it's good to talk to you again, and thank you for that very generous introduction. I appreciate it.
I am very impressed with how well you write in this genre for young readers. And of course, that's not all that you do. In fact, you're probably best known for books that are not written necessarily with young readers in mind at all. Can you remind us about at what point you began devoting at least some of your time and energy into this kind of writing, and what drew you to this sort of arena?
Yeah, I can tell you exactly how it happened. In 2005, I was reading the book Hoot, that Carl Hiaasen wrote, a kid's book, with my son Danny, who was 10 at the time, and we loved the book. And as luck would have it, Carl Hiaasen and I have the same agent, Esther Newberg, in New York, and I wanted to drop Carl a note telling him how much we'd enjoyed it, so I called the office, and Esther's then-assistant, Christine Bauck, answered the phone, and as she was getting his email for me, she said, "Have you ever thought about writing children's books? You talk about your kids all the time." My kids were 10 and 7 at the time. And there's not that much in the sports genre for kids. And I thought, geez, you know, maybe that might be fun. I came up with an idea to set a book at the Final Four, since at that point I think I'd covered 28 of them. So it was a place, a place I knew. And I set a mystery there with two teenagers, a boy and a girl, who win a writing contest, one that actually exists, because I like my fiction to read as if it might be nonfiction, at least up to a certain point. That's why I put real people into all these books. And the book did great. It won the Edgar Allan Poe Award for mystery writing in the young adult category. It was a New York Times bestseller. And I enjoyed doing it because my kids were really my editors. They read behind me as I was writing the book, so I didn't sound like a dork when I had the kids, you know, when I was creating dialogue for the kids. A perfect example was my son pointed out to me that when kids instant messaged each other, they didn't write, "Are you there?" A-R-E-Y-O-U. They wrote the letter R, the letter U. And I learned from them. So it was a fun experience. The book did well. And this Game Changers is now my 14th book. in the kids' mystery genre. And I got to tell you, not only has it been great fun, Greg, but it's been extremely gratifying because of the letters I've gotten and, you know, emails and things from parents. Parents of boys saying, I have a son who doesn't like to read, but he loves sports, and I gave him your book, and when's the next one coming out? And even better from the parents of girls, because in that first series that started with Last Shot, the Sports Beat series, there were six books, the girl, Susan Carroll, was the jock. She in book six, she makes the Olympic team as a swimmer. The boy is not. I mean, he loves sports, but he's not a jock. And in this book, in these books, Andy and Jeff are both good athletes. And a lot of parents have written to me and said, thank you for making the girl the jock. And thank you for acknowledging that in this day and age, girls are athletes the same way boys are athletes, which when I was growing up, Greg, was not the case because girls didn't have the opportunities. And then Title IX changed the world for the better. I have two daughters now, and they both play all sorts of sports.
I remember us having an interview about your book Final Four, and I am so glad to see that that was the start of something really big and really successful and really fun for you. For those of you just joining us,
certainly the start of something I've enjoyed greatly. That's for certain.
For sure. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with best-selling author John Feinstein about his latest book, yet another book for young readers called Game Changers. It follows up on an earlier novel, which was called Bench Warmers. Explain a little more about the two main characters who we would first meet in Bench Warmers and who we get to know even better in Game Changers.
Yeah, sure. Andrea, who goes by Andy, and Jeff are the two main characters. They're sixth graders, as I think you mentioned earlier. In Bench Warmers, the middle school where they both go does not have a girls' soccer team. It has a girls' field hockey team. Andy is a very good soccer player, and she wants to try out for the boys' team because she thinks she's good enough to make it. And, in fact, she is. But there's a misogynist coach who doesn't think girls should be on a boys' team, and so he cuts her, even though she's probably one of the three or four best players out there. And Jeff, whose dad works for a local TV station in Philadelphia, helps her get on the team by publicizing what the coach has been doing. And that's really where the plot evolves from, and the two of them become good friends, and Andy becomes a very important player on the team and has to win over not only the coach but some of her teammates. Not all of them, but some of them. And you wish in 2020 that sort of thing didn't exist, just as we wish in 2020 that racism didn't exist, but they do. And in this book, the second one, Game Changers, now it's basketball season. Jeff's on the boys' team, and Andy's on the girls' team. And the boys' team has, you know, squabbles that 11- and 12-year-olds will have, trying to figure out how to get along with one another and how to play as a team. I don't want to preach in these books, Greg, but I try to put messages in there for the kids about what's right and what's wrong and about how you deal with things in sports and in life. The girls' team has a bigger problem. They have a coach who's a racist, who stereotypes the African-American kids on the team, and mostly out of ignorance. And the girls, as the season goes on, realize what's going on. And eventually they revolt, and that's where the plot kind of builds to a crescendo. And again, it gets back. I wrote this book long before George Floyd was murdered because I've always thought that that race has been the elephant in the room in sports and in our society for years. I mean, just go back to Colin Kaepernick and go back to the national anthem protests of 2017 and the way so many white people reacted to them. And of course, we've seen it more now, sadly, in the last 6 months. But it gets back again to my belief that kids who are reading these books, middle schoolers, high schoolers, whomever they might be, they know what's going on in the world. And they can read this and go, yeah, that can happen in real life.
Mm-hmm. One thing that's very interesting about this book is that we so like the two main protagonists, Jeff and Andy. I mean, they're not only talented athletes, but they're just good kids. I mean, really,
right.
Just good, all-around, likable kids. And yet, they get in trouble. And I don't mean get in trouble in the sense of, you know, smoking behind the shed kind of trouble. but they get in trouble because of what they're doing with the very, very best of intentions. And I think that is really an interesting idea, to have two good kids who nevertheless do not find the way easy, sometimes exactly because that they are good kids with principles and integrity, and sometimes the adults in their lives don't know what to make of that. Can you tell us more about just how ripe that kind of ground is for writing a novel?
Well, first of all, I'm a big believer that there are often times when we can learn from our kids. I know I have throughout my life, or ever since I've had kids. But beyond that, as a reader, when I'm writing, I try to think, I think like the reader that I am, not just the writer. And if somebody has, if I see a movie or read a book and there's nobody to root for, I have trouble getting into it. I think you need somebody to root for. It can't just be all bad guys. And throughout all of these kids' books I've written now, 14 of them, I've tried to have protagonists that the reader wants to root for. But you're right, they do get in trouble. I would never compare myself to J.K. Rowling because she's a genius. But in the Harry Potter books, Harry, Ron, and Hermione, who are all good kids, are constantly in trouble because they step out of the lines of behavior that are supposed to exist in order to try to find out who the bad guys are and how to stop the bad guys. Now, on a completely different level, that's what Jeff and Andy are doing in this book. Andy is the one who first stands up and says, this is wrong in terms of the way their coach is handling them. And Jeff is the one who tries to get the team to come together in spite of the fact that there are a couple of very good players that nobody really likes. And he tries to do the right things, and Andy tries to do the right things. And I think because of that, even though, as you said correctly, they do get in trouble, they're getting in trouble for trying to do the right things, for trying to make things better for the people around them.
Right, exactly. Another thing that's interesting in your book, and I'm really glad that this element is there as well, is that there are other good kids in Game Changers, and then there are some kids that seem to at least at first sort of play the role of semi-villains. I mean,
right.
not terrible kids, but not nearly so likable as Jeff and Andy. And without giving too much away, in a couple of instances, either they change or we change in terms of how we perceive these kids that at first really seem like, you know, they're wearing the black hats and Andy and Jeff are wearing the white hats, so to speak. And I just wonder if you just say a word about how tricky it is to make that plausible for somebody to in fact not be the villain that we at first think that they are. It's a great device.
Well, I think you hit on it in the way you asked the question. And you said they maybe wear the black hats, but they're not terrible people. And so it's easier to have characters who have maybe done some things wrong, said some things that are wrong, learn as we go along in the book than if they're just pure evil. You know, I'm a big believer that there's no real black and white in terms of most people, putting the current president aside, in the world, that everybody has flaws, and even, you know, bad people who appear to be bad have good streaks in them. There's no better example in my life than Bob Knight, who the good side of Bob Knight was as good as anybody I've ever met. The bad side of Bob Knight was almost as bad as anybody I've ever met. And both were very much a part of his character. And so I've always believed that if you can take kids, you know, there are some mean girls in this book early on. But as time goes by and they come to understand what's going on around them, and when Andy and some of the other kids help them understand what's going on around them, they do change. And they don't necessarily, I mean, change in the sense of changing the way they're looking at things. I don't think people completely change their personalities, but and so I don't think it's that hard to make the evolution of these kids plausible when you start out with the premise that they're not evil. They're just people who are they're 11 and 12 year olds. They're learning, and they grow up through this process.
Another thing I really appreciate about this book, right off the bat, it reminded me of something that I really hate about the old TV show Glee, and a lot of shows like that, in which the students are a whole lot smarter than the teachers, that the teachers are all kind of bumbling idiots,
right.
To a cartoonish extent. I just, as someone who's a teacher, I guess that's one reason why that really rubs me wrong. And so
I'm the husband of a teacher, so I understand.
Right. And that being said, I really appreciate the fact that when the teachers and coaches in your book, in a sense, get in the way of the protagonists, it's not because they're dumb, it's not because they're clueless, it's not because they're heartless. It's often because they are adults and they are viewing things through a very different lens than the youngsters are. And so when it comes to something like the sixth grade basketball team, I mean, certain decisions are made about who's going to coach the girls' team, and they're choices that those sixth graders certainly wouldn't make, and it makes no sense to them and so on, but it does make some sense to the adults. And I really appreciate that you've set up that dynamic as carefully as you do. And I wonder if you can just say a word about the care with which you have tried to shape the adults that are in this novel.
Well, again, I don't think adults are black and white any more than kids are black and white. And there are teachers who are better teachers than others. There are coaches that are better coaches than others in the real world. And how many times do we say to our kids when we're trying to explain something and they either don't want to get it or don't get it, and you say, you'll understand when you're older. Well, sometimes they will, and sometimes we understand that they were making a very good point. I think that's the best way you parent, is to understand that maybe you're wrong sometimes, you make wrong decisions, and try to correct them as best you can. And the same is true of teaching or coaching or being in any position of authority, regardless of the what kind of life you're leading. And so in this book, there are coaches and teachers who are trying to do things for the right reasons, and maybe they're still getting it wrong. You know, it's like the old saying in coaching, sometimes you make the right decision and it turns out wrong. You send a pitcher to the mound who you think is going to get that last out, and he ends up giving up a home run. You know, it happens. But I think that again, I try very hard in all of these books to have the characters evolve, to have them learn. I want the kids to learn. As I said, I try to send messages in the way I write these books without preaching. And by having all the characters learn as they go in Game Changers and in these other books, I think it makes it more real, and I think it makes it more fun to read. In the first book, in Benchwarmers, the coach who wants to cut Andy from the soccer team at the start of the season because he doesn't think a girl should be playing with boys comes 180 degrees and realizes that her being on the team has been a very good thing, and becomes a defender of hers, because he's not a bad person. He was just a person who was living in the past, as many people do. It's still hard. You know, I'll give you an example in football. In the NFL draft 3 years ago, the Chicago Bears somehow took Mitchell Trubisky ahead of Patrick Mahomes and Deshaun Watson, who were both available, with the number 2 pick. And I believe, and many people I know and respect in the NFL believe, that there was a racial element to it. That, you know, Mitchell Trubisky looked like what most fans would want in an NFL quarterback. The problem was he wasn't nearly as good as Patrick Mahomes or Deshaun Watson. And so the Bears now are in a position where they're terrible and they need a quarterback. And look at the Kansas City Chiefs.
There you go. Right.
And it doesn't mean that Ryan Pace, the general manager, was a bad person. It just means he was a guy living in the past to some degree.
And probably
he's probably going to lose his job at the end of the season.
Right, and probably not aware of it in the same way that this coach in your novel, who is to us quite obviously racist,
right,
in her own mind,
she's shocked.
Yeah, in her own mind does not see that at all, and that's also kind of a fascinating journey. I also appreciate that that your novel is, let's say, lightly peppered with references to things that are outside of the exploits of these two basketball teams, but not a lot. And, I mean, I think sometimes, you know, there might be part of us that would wish that, well, I mean, are they ever in math class, or does anything ever else happen, you know, outside of, and these two characters, in a sense, seem really quite kind of consumed with what's going on. And of course, that, at least generally speaking, is often the way sixth graders operate. I mean, and when someone is, for instance, a talented basketball player, that really is of paramount importance, and that's where their energies are focused. And in that same way, that sort of, it feels very plausible or very authentic that that's kind of the way Jeff and Andy see the world and kind of the way you've shaped this world in your novel.
Well, I think some of that at least comes from my own experience, to be honest, because I was a jock as a kid. I played all sports. I grew up in an era where you played all sports as opposed to nowadays where parents try to have their kids focus on one sport by the time they're 10 years old and be obsessed with it 12 months a year, which I think is completely wrong, but that's another subject for another day. I remember when I was in the eighth grade, I was a little bit older. I had an English grammar teacher I couldn't stand. And I wasn't particularly interested in English grammar, and that's why I still make grammatical mistakes in my writing to this day. But my English grammar class was last period. And I figured out that if I said something, because he didn't like me either, if I said something early in class that he didn't like, he was going to throw me out. And that meant I could go downstairs and get ready for basketball practice 45 minutes earlier than anybody else, go down and shoot and get ready. And so I literally got myself thrown out of English class just about every day until the teacher finally figured out what I was doing and stopped throwing me out. And so that's to your point that, sure, if you're a jock, Jeff and Andy are both jocks, the most important thing in your life are the sports you're playing. Now, that doesn't mean you don't go to school, and I certainly got in trouble with my parents because of my relationship with this teacher. But that's what kids do. I think you're completely right. That's what kids do. And Andy is a very good student. Jeff is an okay student. Girls usually are better students than boys, at least in my experience with my three kids. So I hear what you're saying, and there's no question that it's true. And when I became a swimmer in high school, that was all I cared about, was swimming, because ultimately I realized swimming was what was going to get me into college, not my grades.
Hmm. Well, and of course, if Andy and Jeff weren't so, in a sense, consumed, in the best sense of the word, by what was going on with their basketball teams and what was going wrong, then, in a sense, they wouldn't go on kind of the dramatic and sort of almost dangerous journey that they undertake to try to make what they see as really bad situations better. And if somebody had kind of a lackadaisical attitude about this basketball team, well, it really doesn't matter, well, then all these things going wrong don't matter either. But in fact, it all matters terribly to Jeff and to Andy, and they're really willing to do just about anything to try to make it.
Well, if they don't care, Greg, if they don't care the way you're describing, then there's no book.
Right. And, and there very much is a book. I mean, and we are so taken up with these two young people and in a sense their respective causes, and it just reads so excitingly. I loved it. I mean, as a 60-year-old and not even much of a basketball fan, I absolutely loved this book. I really, really did. And I know especially young people will enjoy Game Changers, published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux, and the author John Feinstein. John Feinstein, congratulations on yet another wonderful book, and thank you for being part of the morning
show.
Thanks
for having me. I hope we do it again, and happy holidays.
You too. John Feinstein, the late John Feinstein, who passed away on the 13th of March at the age of just 69. What a pleasure and honor to speak with him on repeated occasions over the years. Tomorrow on the morning show, Kaylin Palomares in her monthly visit to the program. Brandon Gross will be her special guest, who heads up the Root River chapter of Wild Ones. We'll be talking about the eradication of invasive species. We have a turbulent weather forecast with all kinds of complicated precipitation in the forecast, including the possibility of hail, freezing rain, snow, and so on. WGTD HD.